على عهدي على ديني على أرض تلاقيني أنا لأهلي أنا فديهم أنا دمي فلسطيني 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 أنا دمي فلسطيني.
Tammy asked me to come down here and talk about solidarity, you know, between blacks and Palestinians. And it got me thinking about this project, you know, this historical project that's part of our day-to-day lives. That's the same. It seems to be the same people. If it's not the same people, it's the same vibration. It's the same intent. This settler colonial project involving imperialism and colonialism and extraction of wealth through genocide that has fueled the industries that control our lives, right? And has contributed to what we imagine is possible between the time we get up in the morning and go to bed at night, between the time we are born and the time we die. And coming into self-awareness, it's like every day, the older we become, the more aware we become, the sharper our awareness gets, the more we pay attention, the more disempowering it can feel to see how intricately woven together the systems are, right? This is called obvious. Something in its bloodstream. Activated by the sunbeams. He's ready to eat because he's hungry. People respect him. It's humbling. He's focused on one thing. All he wants is to come clean. He's thinking about freedom and how for so many it's unseen. Alienate my mind state. Exclude what I exude. Erase my alignment and remove what we include. Replace my environment with assignments and rules. Then deny your collusion as if I'm some kind of fool. Molotov monologue. False facade, falling off, interrupting the seduction of a destruction, a holocaust. Intellect infested with sickness and death, affliction and addiction that infected the flesh, incessant obsession with repression and oppression, deception and depression, naked aggression and loaded weapons. I'm checking and assessing all assets in my possession, but what direction is the exit? That's the essence of the question. I'm keeping it rhyming exotic like an ancient narcotic, reminding my mind and my body to God as my audience to keep my cognitive positive. Thought is provocative. I walk my prerogative and it's more than just talkative. The situation is obvious. Observing it, watching it. Preserving it in documents, though it's burnt in my consciousness. Call it dichotomy. It's perfectly opposite. I'm searching for profit with the heart of a communist. Dense inert, metal explosives, depleted uranium, ferocious, atrocious. They shot them and smoked them, provoked them and choked them. We caught it on camera all about in the open. No convictions or charges. They get acquitted and pardoned. It's their intent to sow dissent in the garden. A carpet of corpses darkens a harvest. They calculate the calories to keep them close to starving. The state creates terror, then they blame it on Arabs while you fixating on Drake and debating gay marriage. This whole apparatus is anti-personnel. They exploit us or destroy us or they put us in jail. No, they can't stop us from enjoying ourselves as we rob and our demise in a poisonous hell. I vocalize defiantly, they violate violently. A dynasty, a piracy, that's minding your privacy. I'm keeping it rhyming exotic like an ancient narcotic, reminding my mind and my body that God is my audience. I keep my cognitive positive, thought is provocative. I walk my prerogative and it's more than just talkative. The situation is obvious. Observing it, watching it, I preserve it in documents, though it's burnt in my consciousness. Call it dichotomy. It's perfectly opposite. I'm searching for profits, the heart of a communist. Thank you.
أنا لأهلي أنا فديهم أنا دمي فلسطيني 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 أنا دمي فلسطيني.
What's up, Portland? This is Kat Petru, and you're tuned into 90.7 FM on KBOO, Portland. That was the voice of Mike Crenshaw artist, educator, and revolutionary, speaking a few weeks ago at a gathering for solidarity with Palestine. And the song that you heard is Dami Falastini by Mohammed Asaf. This is Radio Zine and my first time on the KBOO airwaves. I was trained in radio at KPFA, which is a sister station to KBOO, down in occupied Ohlone land in Berkeley, California. And I'm also the co-founder of We Rise Production, which is a multimedia collective of artists and producers nourishing our liberation movements with media, with storytelling, and with community organizing. It's great to be here. And I'm joined by Layla Kanaan. Would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Yeah. So my name is Layla Kanaan, as Kat just said. And I've been involved in different Palestinian events and organizations around Portland. I grew up going to Palestine and seeing and experiencing the occupation firsthand. So working towards liberation for Palestine, for my family, for my friends, has always been a priority in my life. So I'm really happy to be here.
I'm really glad you're here. And I can share that I am born and raised in Huchin, which is occupied Oakland, California. And I'm Jewish. And as I started to learn more about my Jewish roots, it was concomitant at the same time as being politicized and learning about Zionism. And I started connecting with, collaborating with Palestinian youth movement folks in the Bay. And when I came up here, I just stepped right in, starting with last year's Nakba Day. And this is a special day of programming for Nakba Day. And so we're here to talk about the history of Palestine, the history of Zionism, history of Nakba Day, and what's happening now. Is there anything you want to add?
I'm really excited and happy that we have this much support for Nakba Day and recognizing this catastrophe that Palestinians have gone through. So I think this is really important programming.
It's vital. There's so much misinformation out there. Yeah, thank you. So we're going to dive in hearing from Ramzi, who is the founder of the Center for the Study and Preservation of Palestine. And he was one of the main organizers for last year's Nakba Day events. So we'll hear from him now. He'll give a little context, and then Layla's going to bring us deeper into the roots of this day.
It is easy to believe anything when you ignore history and the voices of the oppressed. It is easy to accept the unacceptable, the atrocious. When you dehumanize the victims of atrocity, it is easy to claim you did not see what is plainly in broad daylight when you actively uplift and support the mechanisms that place the veil before your eyes. That ignoring, that dehumanizing, that veil is for you to live easily while our people are ripped from our lands and livelihoods. That ignoring, that dehumanizing, that veil makes it easy for you to actually participate and support the uprooting of our people. It has always been about one thing in the US, to aid in imperialism everywhere, because it is easier than not. We're here today, as we have always been as Palestinians in the diaspora, here to make it difficult for you to remain silent.
That's right.
Difficult to go back to your ignoring and your claims of ignorance. Al-Nakba, an Arabic word that means the catastrophe, has been memorialized in Palestinian hearts and minds to describe the events that occurred between 1947 and 1949 in order to create the Zionist occupation state of Israel, which declared its colonialist occupation one sovereignty in April of 1948. Between 1947 and 1949, upwards of 800,000 Palestinians were forcefully displaced, fled for their lives, lost their homes, their land, their livelihoods, their dreams, their future dreams, as the fledgling occupation state violently sieged and occupied over 400 villages across Palestine. At that time, Palestinians found themselves landless, houseless, and without agency, seeking refuge in the still unoccupied parts of Palestine, in Jordan, in Syria, and other parts of the Arab world. They walked with their possessions, holding and supporting their elders up, carrying their children, many recently widowed due to the massacres, seeking refuge wherever it may be. They found tent camps, temporary accommodations, and for many, only the never-ending road. The fate of 1948 Palestinians, as we call them, was in the hands of others, and their trajectories and displacement was diverse. For many with hands full of the few heirlooms they might have been lucky enough to grab, especially keys to their homes, which they harbored a hope to return to, this was the last time that they saw their beloved land. Them and their future descendants would never see Palestine. Us Palestinians commemorate and mourn the losses, but we also resist the illegitimate narrative of the occupier today. We do so every year, Nakba Day. Today you will hear stories of the Nakba and what that means to Palestinians here in your city, what they and their families experience in relation to the Nakba, but also how they continue to experience it. I want to express something before our speakers tell you their stories. In actuality, the Nakba did not begin in 1948, and it never, ever ended. I mentioned history just a moment ago, and its importance not to ignore.
So again, that was Ramzi from the Center for Study and Preservation of Palestine. I'm Kat Petru, and you're tuned in to 90.7 FM KBOO Portland, and this is our radio zine for special programming for Nakba Day. And I'm joined by Leila Kanan. And I would love for you to speak more to the history that Ramzi is alluding to.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the start of Zionism is a really great place to start, because talking about the creation of Zionism dispels this myth that the Israel-Palestine, you know, quote, conflict is thousands of years old. You know, it's just not true. Palestine, for the majority of its existence, was a stable and peaceful place for Jews, Muslims, Christians. I mean, their religious figureheads and religious holidays were intertwined for a period of time. For example, Palestinian Muslims would celebrate religious festivities in honor of the prophets and holy men of Judaism. So considering that Christianity, Islam, and Judaism are all Abrahamic religions, it really only makes sense that there is a celebrated connection between the three. So I just wanted to start off by dispelling that myth. This is not thousands of years old. This is a matter of 120 years old. So another myth is that Jewish immigration started during the Holocaust and World War II. However, it started much earlier, like I said, with the creation of Zionism. Zionism started during the final decades of the Ottoman Empire and before its collapse in World War II with Theodor Herzl. So there really is a lot to dive in, so I'll do my best to give you, you know, a brief overview of the history of Zionism and really how dangerous it's turned out to be. So the first Zionist Congress meeting convened in 1897 with over 200 delegates from all over Europe. And although there were some more like haphazard Zionist movements along the way, the meeting of the Zionist Congress was really the first that put their colonial project into effect. So let's back up a little bit. What is Zionism? It's a settler colonial political movement that calls for the establishment of a Jewish-only state in the land of Palestine with a Jewish majority. But what was their plan for the already established Palestinians living in Palestine for centuries? They really had one of two options, either come to an agreement or remove them by force. This was, you know, in their opinion, what were their two options? So I'll also define settler colonialism because it does differ from classic colonialism. Settler colonialism is mainly defined by a desire to colonize the land of a foreign country. In this case, it's Palestine. There are some other examples like the Americas, Australia, South Africa, etc. But rather than extracting the resources from a land like classic colonialism does, settlers are looking for new homelands by claiming the land is their divine and moral right. So despite the fact that Palestine was already home to nearly 500,000 Palestinians at the time, Zionists felt that Palestine was theirs to take. As Ilan Poppy said in his book, The 10 Myths About Israel, which I highly recommend for anyone who is looking to dispel these myths that we hear about Israel all the time, he said, "The accepted method for overcoming such obstacles was the genocide of the indigenous locals." And as we'll see, this is exactly what happened. So with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire in World War I and Palestine subsequently coming under the British mandate, this was really the perfect opportunity for the Zionists to start their colonization of Palestine. The British were far more supportive of a Jewish state within Palestine, so much so that in 1917, Lord Balfour created the Balfour Declaration, which promised to help establish a, quote, national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. Although the document clearly outlines the rights and freedoms of the current non-Jewish population there, aka the Palestinians, as we will see, these principles were neither enforced or even regarded with much validity. With the support from the British, the Zionist movement really ramped up their colonization efforts, all the while Palestinian organizations who were pushing against Zionists were harshly squashed by the British. This double standard from the British would really pave the way for the Nakba of 1948 and the establishment of Israel and all of the atrocities Palestinians would come to face. So that's really the start of the colonization of Palestine. It doesn't go back, again, like to 2,000 years. It really goes back to only about 120, and things really unraveled from there.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that you broke down settler colonialism. I think it's a buzzword that sometimes folks will hear and sort of glaze over. And it's just, it's a very specific act, and it's ongoing, and it's pervasive, and it's something I think that many of our liberation movements today are recognizing how we have in common as far as what we're up against. And it informs our visions for the future and for how we can heal and get free. And again, there's such misinformation that's so old and so deep when it comes to the settler state of Israel that I think as much as we can just share this information, that's part of the work. So thank you so much for breaking that down. So as you named, and as we heard from Ramzi, and as we are leading up to this day of action this coming weekend on May 15th, can you speak to the history of Nakba Day?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's a bit of a jump forward from, you know, 1917 Balfour Declaration. But by the end of the British Mandate in 1948, European Zionist settlers had really only controlled 5 to 6% of the land in Mandatory Palestine. And they constituted only a third of the population, despite this effort of theirs to push for full colonization and this huge PR campaign that the Zionists were backing. So in 1947, the UN presented a partition plan in hopes of bringing peace to the two sides. Well, the plan would give Jews 56% of Mandatory Palestine. And I might add that they were given the most fertile areas of land in Palestine. They were given the coastal lands. They were given agricultural lands. And a lot of this was Palestinians use this as their means of survival. So giving up those really fertile pieces of land was already like a knock to Palestinians. While Palestinians, on the other hand, were only allocated 43% of the land that was rightfully theirs, even though they made up the majority of the population. So right off the bat, this peaceful unification partition plan that the UN was trying to give to the Palestinians and the Zionists, well, it was already unfair and unequal. So how did the Palestinians react to this partition plan? Well, of course, they rejected it. You know, how could they come to terms with giving up the majority of their land to a minority settler group that had only been there for, you know, a few decades? I mean, it's unfathomable. And in fact, Zionists didn't even fully accept this partition plan either for, you know, very different reasons, though. Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, said that the acceptance of the partition plan would be temporary. He said, quote, "After the formation of a large army in the wake of the establishment of the state, we will abolish partition and expand to the whole of Palestine." That says it all right there. They weren't going to listen to this UN partition plan. They weren't going to listen to any of these groups that were really trying to, I guess, provide, quote, peace to the region. So regardless of the partition plan, you know, who agreed to what, the Zionists were sticking to their plan and taking all of Palestine as their own. That was their plan. And it is important to say that the ethnic cleansing of Palestine started before 1948. Approximately 300,000 Palestinians had been expelled through ethnic cleansing campaigns prior to 1948. And again, I encourage you to look up these Arab revolts that happened in the 30s to really give you some context for how we got to this point. I will also say, surprisingly, there were efforts from the U.S. backed by other Arab states to prevent war in 1948. and for the Zionist state to hold off until negotiations could happen. Of course, Ben-Gurion rejected this, with the understanding that if he were to accept those conditions, they would have to allow the 300,000 displaced Palestinians to return home, and no Zionist was going to let that happen. War would also allow the Zionists to conquer more land outside of the designated partition plan. So in the eyes of Zionists, war was necessary. So now here we are. The war of 1948, or Nakba, or the catastrophe, took place, and by the end of the war, nearly 800,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed from their homes, and over 400 villages and communities were destroyed or colonized. Israel was literally established in the rubble of these villages, and I am not exaggerating. The post-war armistice line would become known as the Green Line, and it marked the de facto borders of the Israeli state. So the West Bank and Gaza would be ruled by Jordan and Egypt, respectively, and 80% of the Palestinian population living within the Green Lines were expelled, and the remaining 20% would live under martial law, being ruled by apartheid Israel still to this day.
This is a deft segue into a short clip I wanted to share from Henna, who is a student organizer with SUPER, which is Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights. She also was part of the organizing of last year's Nakba Day. And she tells a story that really illuminates some of the violence and trauma of what you just spoke about.
I want to tell you today about my family stories, about the village they lived in Palestine and the generational impact of settler colonialism. My family comes from farmers in Yaffa. The village of Al-Abbasiyya was covered in rows of olive trees and orange groves. In Al-Abbasiyya, land was central to life, as it was all over Palestine. Okay. The land nurtured us, fed us, sheltered us, clothed us. We cared for it, and it cared for us. In Palestinian villages, we lived collectively. Your neighbor was someone to borrow a cup of sugar from, a babysitter, someone to have tea with, a source of protection. My great-grandfather was the mayor of the village during the Nakba. From what my grandmother has told me, he loved his job. He was a person people went to with problems, big or small, and it wasn't that his position had dictative authority or final say on all matters, but we were able to utilize everyone's strengths and knew everyone's needs so we could all survive and thrive together. They protected each other from the settler and state violence caused by Zionist settler colonialism that was invading from the east. Racist Zionist mobs attacked the village over and over again to scare the inhabitants into leaving. There were car bombings, grenades thrown into houses, and Zionist mobs broke into homes to kill and displace the families who lived there. The horror. Recorded and shared by the descendants of 48 and 67 refugees. The Nakba is ongoing and the U.S. is funding it. In May of 1948, Al-Abbasiyya was ethnically cleansed of Palestinians. All that is left of the village today after settlers destroyed it is part of the village mosque and the Nabi Huda's shrine. The village was taken over for and by settlers to make it their traveling through routes easier between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. We must heed the calls made by the Palestinian civil society to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel. We must organize around unequivocal support for Palestinian struggle and liberation and resistance in all its entirety. We must go school by school, city by city, and build a strong transnational movement. As Hassan Kanafani said, imperialism has laid its body over the world, the head in Eastern Asia, the heart in the Middle East, and its arteries reaching Africa and Latin America. Wherever you strike it, you damage it, and you serve the world revolution. When colonized and oppressed people rise up to take their lands back, the parallels between our collective struggles become explicit. From Palestine to Colombia, from Turtle Island to the Philippines, from India to Afghanistan, we know that the settler state does not keep us safe. We keep us safe. We will fight for our collective liberation and we will win.
So that was Henna, student organizer with SUPER, which is Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights. I'm Kat Petru. You're tuned into 90.7 KBOO Portland. And I'm joined by Leila Kanan, who's also been an organizer for Palestinian Liberation in Portland for your whole life.
Basically. Yeah. Yeah. And I resonate with Henna a lot. You know, our families come from the same town, El Abbasiyya, and we have remarkably similar stories. You know, we are, of course, individual people with individual experiences, but for the most part, I mean, the Nakba has touched every single Palestinian family and every single Palestinian home. And it is something that we can all relate to. My family still has the keys and the deeds to their home in El Abbasiyya, which is now, I believe, is called El Yahudiyya, literally means Jewish in Arabic. And so, you know, these stories, they're connected, and, you know, I feel her pain as I'm sure she feels mine. So, you know, I really appreciate hearing that personal story from her, and intertwining it with this heavy facts that I'm providing. So.
Yeah. And I noticed before we went to her speaking, you said that when Zionists came to the land, they took the most fertile parts. And I really heard that reflected in what she shared with how her family was growing. I can't remember what she said, which kinds of trees, maybe olive and other, but she talked about like being so connected to the land and to each other as neighbors. And that's how people took care of each other and took care of the land.
I mean, you know, land is life, like she said. You know, I see it in my family. They have withered from being separate from Palestine or separated from Palestine. And, you know, you can really see that Palestine revitalizes. And so I think it speaks wonders to the importance of being on your homeland and the importance of being able to touch your own soil and, yes, be with your people. Yeah, no, yeah. I completely agree.
That makes me think of what, you know, you can see when someone is grieving, and that's just like generations and generations of grief, which like we know has serious health impacts, let alone just what it does to our spirits. But, and also, it should never come to that, right? No one should have to endure that. And of course, there is ferocious strength in Palestinian diaspora and in the solidarity work. And I, you know, we opened the show with Mike Crenshaw speaking about Black and Palestinian solidarity, but also speaking to, like you named, the settler colonial project that's operating very similarly, if not the same people, the same companies, the same weapons, both here in Portland on Turtle Island and overseas in Palestine. So again, there's like the same dominant culture. And then as Henna named, there is so much strength in the solidarity and folks are doing incredible, incredible work.
Yeah. I mean, I've said it before and I'll say it again, like intersectional struggle is so important to identify. We cannot do anything if it's just Palestinians alone. I mean, we've seen what it's like to fight solo and to resist the occupier. We've seen what it's like. And it really doesn't gain the traction that we're hoping for. And so creating those connections with Black Lives Matter and with the indigenous struggle and, you know, all over the world, I mean, we see these same parallels that are happening. And so, yes, I mean, intersectional struggle needs to be identified and needs to be fostered in order to make any progress. And I think that we're getting there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't normally speak to this, but I'm feeling called to call out that for any Jews who are listening, this is our struggle too. As Leila named in the beginning, perhaps some of our ancestors shared land, were along the same riverways or waterways or traded, or even shared language and food. There may have been sharing at one point. And also the Jewish people are a diasporic people. We come from many different cultures. And my grandmother is a Holocaust survivor. And it is, the word you used was unfathomable. It is unfathomable to me that my people could turn around and do something like this because it happened to us. But also, as you named, it actually wasn't a result of the Nazi Holocaust that the Israeli state was created. It was actually a colonial plan deliberately named as such by Jews prior. And it's a geopolitical project, right? That it has to do with, like so many of these issues do, with controlling land, controlling resources, building wealth, accumulating wealth, and it lacks completely the spirit of interconnectedness, of interdependence, of basic respect, dignity for human and other life. So, you know, I know lots of Jews out there are like working toward decolonizing themselves in certain ways. And please recognize how this is a part of that, and actively acting in solidarity for Palestinian liberation is part of Jewish decolonization. Does that feel true?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And I also, you know, I want to add that the start of the Zionist movement and the support that it got from the British, Britain's motivation for supporting the Zionist movement was entirely racist. They were anti-Semitic, and they did not want to have to deal with Jewish people in Europe. It is entirely racist. And so I think that that also needs to be understood, that the British, the West, they are not on Jews' side. You know, we are, as a Palestinian and you as a Jew, we are working on this together. We are fighting against that same power. And I think that that's something that's overlooked. I mean, yeah, I think that's something that's overlooked.
Absolutely. Oof, that stirred up a lot. I think there's this really fraught thing that happens in Jewish community, which is like, if you're anti-Zionist, then you're like, quote, I don't even want to say, it's just so ridiculous. And I've heard folks say like, but my people need a safe place to be. And yeah, all people need a safe place to be. This is why there are so many brilliant philosophers, organizers, educators, artists who, since we've had to deal with global colonialism and capitalism, white supremacy, patriarchal project, all of this, all of these projects, recognize that our liberation is bound together. And it's for very specific reasons, in addition to all of the like felt sense of like, yeah, you're alive and I'm alive, why would I want to hurt you kind of thing. But I appreciate you naming the specificity that like, no, truly, same oppressor, and it's the divide and conquer, right? And it's such a brutal, insidious tactic.
And I would say that the West really took advantage of this trauma that Jews went through during World War II and during the Holocaust to gain access to this land. I mean, they say that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and, you know, it's the only democratic outpost, right? And that is, it's an in, it's a doorway for the West to gain control of those resources. And so it's truly like this, you know, the colonizing parents are just taking advantage of this trauma. And it's really heartbreaking to see, and to see the, like, you know, the oppressed become the oppressors. And it's crazy to see this like psychological warfare that's being taken place at the expense now of Palestinians. And yeah, it's just this cycle that we see over and over and over again. And yeah, I mean, going back, like our joint struggles are really, really important for creating a strong foundation.
Mm-hmm. And I just truly feel in my bones the struggles are still joined. And I hope more folks can recognize that, because then we can just be better at what we're already doing. I want to make sure we have time to talk about events on May 15th. Actually, yeah, let's talk about where we are today. And then we can listen to one more organizer from last year's Nakba Day on occupied Chinook, Multnomah, Clackamas, many folks land.
Yeah. So, you know, we're fast forwarding a little bit from the Nakba 1948 expulsion of Palestinians to, you know, more of the 21st century events that have taken place. But I do want to say that it is really important to understand these events that happened in the second half of the 20th century. You know, there's the 1967 war, the 1973 war, both the first and the second Intifada, all of the bombardments in Gaza. These are all really important to learn about and know about in order to understand this context for where we are now. So I encourage all of you listeners to do your own research on these events from this sort of intermediary period. So yes, jumping forward here, you know, I'll talk a little bit about the situation of Gaza, and it's grown increasingly dire. And so I think it is important to kind of highlight what's going on. So the UN predicted that Gaza would be uninhabitable by 2020. Well, we've surpassed 2020, and 2 million people still live in an open-air prison, and most of whom are refugees from the Nakba in 1948. So just imagine the constant bombardment that these people living in this open-air prison have experienced since 1948. I mean, it's truly unimaginable. And I mean it, it is really not an exaggeration to call Gaza an open-air prison. It is besieged on all sides, mainly by Israel and Egypt. There is a land, air, and sea blockade, which prevents Palestinians from accessing the Mediterranean Sea for fishing and the land for farming. It has undergone brutal assaults in 2008 and 2014, but the worst bombardment so far has been in 2018, and this was called the Great March of Return. It started as a peaceful protest on the border of Gaza and Israel, with other resistance groups, you know, popping up all over the West Bank in support. But Gaza really bore the brunt of this violence. They were fighting for their right of return, which is a right that they are granted under international law. If you need a reference for that, you know, see the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, International Covenant on the Civil and Political Rights, the Fourth Geneva Convention, and the UN Resolution 194. Those all highlight a person's right to return to their homeland. So how did Israel respond to this great march of return? Well, naturally, by killing and injuring thousands, I mean thousands of protesters. Amongst those were medical personnel and press that were clearly marked, children, persons who had already been injured and disabled from previous bombardments. And this great march of return was a really big turning point for Palestinians. It really brought the world's attention to Palestine and to Gaza and to this inhumane treatment that Palestinians are faced with every day. So that's all I'm going to say about the Great March of Return. But if you want to learn more about it, there is this fantastic documentary made by Abby Martin called Gaza Fights for Freedom. And that does a really deep dive into the importance of this Great March of Return protest and, you know, why it's so significant to us. So switching gears a little bit, the occupation looks different in the West Bank as it does in Gaza. Where the occupation in Gaza is maintained through, you know, siege and bombardment, Palestinians living in the West Bank experience the daily presence of the occupying military forces. This control really extends to their basic rights. You know, they can't obtain jobs. They can't till their land. They can't even access water. It's become harder and harder to access water, with Israel placing their multitude of settlements on or near water aquifers. You know, I don't think that we understand the importance of water. When I go back to Palestine and I visit my family, you know, we have to watch how much we drink. We have to watch how much we shower. It's really restrictive. On top of all of this, 40% of Palestinian men have been arrested. You know, olive groves are frequently burned and destroyed. This prevents Palestinians from accessing, once again, their means of survival. How can you survive when you do not have access to your farmland, or when your olive groves or citrus trees are burned by settlers? It is violence that we cannot understand. Palestinians must obtain a travel permit to travel outside of their designated areas. My family in Jelezon, which is near Ramallah, they cannot travel to Jerusalem. They cannot travel to visit their sons that are in prison. These permits are extremely difficult to obtain and obviously restrict freedom of movement. Checkpoints are also a major, major obstruction to freedom of movement. People have died waiting at checkpoints to receive medical treatment. Women have given birth at checkpoints. People have just been shot and killed by the Israeli occupation forces at checkpoints. In addition, the apartheid wall, which started construction in 2002, now takes up 8% of Palestinian land, and they haven't even finished building it. This list of restrictions to daily Palestinian life in the West Bank, really, it just goes on and on and on. But I hope this really gives you an idea of what life under occupation looks like and how Israel has created these different ways to violently control Palestinians. So now you might be wondering, well, how can Israel sustain this type of military control over the West Bank and Gaza? Well, Israel receives $3 billion in funding from the U.S. every year. Let me break that down for you. But that's $10 million a day. And where's the U.S. getting that money from? Our tax dollars. Americans are literally funding the genocide and apartheid of Palestine.
Yeah. And another clip we have from last year's Nakba Day 2021 is from Olivia, who's a member of the Democratic Socialists of America and the North American coordinator for the BDS movement. What is BDS? She actually speaks to it in this clip. So let's take a listen and we can keep going.
So BDS, for those who don't know, stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions. It's a call from Palestinian civil society. Palestinians got together in Palestine in 2005 to issue this call for the international community. The BDS call is modeled off the South African anti-apartheid movement, and Palestinians are calling on us as the international community to boycott, divest from, and sanction Israel until Israel complies with international law by meeting three demands. Number one is ending the occupation and dismantling the illegal apartheid wall. Number two is full equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel. And number three is the right of return for Palestinian refugees. So these are the demands of the BDS call, and you can think of it like a picket line. For those of us who are familiar with the labor movement, we would never cross a picket line if workers there were on strike, you know, until their demands were met. And you can think of BDS the same way. We don't cross the picket line. Why BDS is important is because it can take us from sympathy to action. It's very easy to say we sympathize with the Palestinian cause, we're in solidarity with the Palestinian cause, but there is something you can actually do, and that's ending the complicity of our government and institutions right here at home. The United States gives $4 billion a year in military funding to Israel, no strings attached. Yes, and people say the BDS movement singles out Israel, which is like, yes, of course, because it's a call from Palestinians. Like, why would they not be calling on people to boycott Israel? But the United States is actually the one singling out Israel by giving them $4 billion a year in unconditional funding. So one way we can engage in BDS is to end this funding. So I want to give you all a link. You can either write it down, remember it. It is bit.ly/riseupwithpalestine, and the first letters of those words are capitalized, bit.ly/riseupwithpalestine. That will take you to an action page where you can urge our members of Congress to end U.S. military funding to Israel.
Okay, so that was Olivia with the Democratic Socialists of America and the North American coordinator for the BDS, that's Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement. I'm Kat Petru. You're listening to 90.7 KBOO in occupied Portland. And I'm joined by my guest, Leila Kanan. And we're talking about the history of Zionism, of Palestine, of Nakba Day, all gearing up towards this weekend's Nakba Day on May 15th. And we're going to talk more about what's happening then. We also can just clarify that right now, the stats we see are that the U.S. gives $3.8 billion to the settler state of Israel. So between three and four, closer to four, it's a lot of money. I want to get into what's happening this weekend. I'm curious first if you want to respond to anything Olivia said. And there were two threads that I also wanted to weave back in as we wrap up our conversation for today.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it can feel really overwhelming to hear all of this information about Palestine and what's happening to Palestinians and feel like there's nothing that you can do. And I think BDS, like Olivia highlighted, is an extremely important way to get involved. You know, this is a way that you can cut Israeli products and institutions and, you know, cultural institutions and organizations out of your life. I do also recommend you go onto the BDS website. I believe it's just bds.com. And, you know, there's a whole list of different companies you can boycott, from Sabra Hummus to Pillsbury to SodaStream, Puma. I mean, the list goes on. And so the resources are there for you if you are feeling helpless or you are feeling sort of stuck with this information.
Yeah, and BDS, of course, is a global movement. But can you talk more about what's happening here specifically in Portland?
Yeah. So, you know, as far as organizations locally, I've been overwhelmed by the resources that we do have in Portland for Palestinians and those that are hoping to get involved. So, you know, Ramsey, we played a clip from him earlier. He started the CSPP, the Center for Study and Preservation of Palestine, and he really focuses on that cultural and educational aspect of Palestine. You know, they hold events, educational sessions, podcasts. They have educational resources at the CSPP Center, as well as a Palestinian market right next door called Jerusalem Rose Market. You know, I highly recommend checking them out. They are cspp.pdx on Instagram. So, you know, if you're looking for resources and ways to learn, that's a really, really good place to start.
And if you want good hummus, go to Jerusalem Rose.
And dolmas, of course. Amazing.
All of it.
Amazing Palestinian wine as well. Could go on. And then there's also SUPER, again, Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, that has been resurrected at PSU. And they're another incredible group that is run by students. And they're actively working to get PSU to divest from Boeing, which currently has a $735 million contract with Israel. The final organization that I wanted to highlight is Demilitarize PDX to Palestine. They're an organization pushing to end police and state violence in the hopes of achieving liberation for all. They are currently involved in a local campaign against G4S, a private security company that has a $5 million contract with the city of Portland. Demilitarized PDX is working to end that deadly exchange between the Israeli military and the Portland Police Bureau and demand that Oregon Investment Council divest Oregon Pensions from NSO, which is an Israeli spyware firm. You know, Olivia will be at the event this Sunday, and she'll be able to speak more on G4S and NSO and BDS. And she's also a fantastic resource, you know, wherever her involvement may be. So, you know, I will also say that Demilitarized PDX does an incredible job of connecting those intersectional struggles. They highlight the importance of collective liberation, which is a connection that must be made, you know, whenever we're talking about Black or Indigenous or Palestinian rights. All of these organizations have been involved in the planning of the NECBA Day event, and it really, really wouldn't have happened without their help.
Yeah, they're amazing, every single one. I appreciate you highlighting each of them. Is there anything else you can tell our listeners about the event this weekend?
Absolutely. So as far as what to expect on Sunday, this is May 15th, we will be meeting at 12:30 at Salmon Springs, which is the fountain at the waterfront on downtown. Then we'll march over to City Hall for a rally with speeches and a deeper explanation of NECBA Day and its significance, as well as, like I mentioned, a diving deeper into G4S, NSO, and BDS. We will then march for about 30 minutes and end up at PSU to hear more about Super, as well as highlight other organizations that are also working towards that collective liberation. At PSU, we'll have food trucks, raffles, music, dancing. Basically, it will be a celebration of Palestinian life and culture while sharing stories and learning about action items and what you can do. So I really hope to see a big crowd there.
So beautiful. And I can say I was there last year, and it was such a profound present. We were downtown and gathered in like a semicircle, and almost everyone who spoke told a story and told a personal story. Emotions were running so high, and I felt like every pause was just like there was a reverence there. And it sounds like this year's event will probably hold some of that same storytelling and the same, you know, fierce organizing spirit, but it also feels like there's going to be even more sort of dancing and music and food and that livelihood. And I think for folks who have been more timid around social movements or have had less information or whatever, it can be really intimidating. And I think this weekend is going to be really special and really informative and a great chance to just meet folks as well and kind of start getting connected with this kind of work.
Yeah, and just see that there is a Palestinian community here, and we do exist, and we are fighting for our people, and, you know, we're looking for that support. And I think that this is one way that you can really show up for us, is just come to our event and engage with us and learn from us. It's really going to be great and powerful.
So as far as how folks can learn more, we will put links in the show notes. I will put links to most of the resources you named. Where can they learn more about the event details?
Super at PSU are really the group that's behind this NECBA Day event. And if you wanted to learn more information about, you know, where to go, what will be happening on Sunday, I recommend giving them a follow on Instagram, PSU_Super, S-U-P-E-R. They also have, you know, just in general, really great resources. And, you know, I'm sure that they'll be organizing other events in the future.
Thank you. Is there anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
You know, my whole life, I have always been afraid to talk about Palestine. I've always been pretty ashamed to talk about Palestine because there is this, you know, negative connotation of us being terrorists or, you know, just uncivilized or something. And I think, you know, in the past 10 years, I've like really come into this feeling of pride, and it's only helped to see that people in Portland are here to support. And there are more and more resources for people. And I, you know, I hate to say it, but I really need that support behind me and behind other Palestinians to feel that we're going anywhere. And so I just, you know, I need to say an overarching words of appreciation for the support that I've felt in Portland and beyond. So, you know, I guess I'll close out with that.
Thank you for expressing that, and thank you for being here. It certainly takes courage to speak up at all, and I think we can learn together and practice together. So thank you so much. And you spoke about the importance of water, and, you know, of course, we've been hearing for years, if not generations, that water is life. It's really central in decolonial movements on Turtle Island. And so I just wanted to lift that up because we've been talking about solidarity with Palestine, solidarity in our social movements. So I just wanted to name that. And I'll just give a shout out. We're going to hear from Miriam, who is an artist, teacher, and revolutionary, who spoke a few weeks ago at this Gathering for Solidarity with Palestine event. And you'll also hear Long Live Palestine by Loki. And again, I've been your host, Kat Petru. Got my radio chops at KPFA on occupied Ohlone land in Berkeley, California. And I'm one of the co-founders of We Rise Production. And we'll link to that in show notes as well. We recorded everything from last year's Nakba Day. And so you can hear actually these full speeches from Ramzi, from Henna, from Olivia. Layla also spoke, as well as many others. And we can link to that there. And I think Layla has one more thing to share with us.
You know, just speaking on the importance of water, I just wanted to highlight that the CSPP does water runs to Warm Springs every week. And so, you know, if you ever want to show support, I know that they could use the funds to get that water to Warm Springs. So just one more shout out to CSPP and all the amazing work that they're doing there.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining us. And for all of you listening, thank you so much for your generous attention. And we hope to see you out on Sunday.
When I rest for justice, I know that justice walks with me. And when I rage for justice, I know justice walks with me. And when I'm creative for justice, I know justice walks with me. And when I speak for justice, I know justice walks with me. And when I listen for justice, I know justice walks with me. And when I teach my students who are alive, I do it because justice walks with me. And when I teach others about my students who died, it's because justice walks with me. And when every now and then I'm weak and I bind to the capitalism and I buy something and call it self-care, and I hold myself accountable, justice walks with me. And when I'm here today for self-care, and I feel guilty that I even should care about myself in a time like this, I come back to self-love because justice walks with me. We're much bigger than anything that tells you you can't. Please know that. They are just as overwhelmed and confused by resilience. Who can hold their breath the longest? Can I spit a piece?
Yes! Yes.
All right. I woke up this year with the shroud of the hungry. Like, of all your loans, I don't owe you my body. My money, and all your clothes, I don't owe you my body. And this language too that I learned to be fluent in, honey, I mean, I came here for the coffee and nobody asked. Walking down a road that will seldom last, land that's stolen, sky lies broken by military choppers that cut so fast that I'm supposed to aspire in this, to stay free, supposed to perspire in this, and legally. Ever since 2020, I tear down IDs, I'm winking at the trees, I'm not getting degrees just so you can see me. Matter of fact, don't look. Don't even read my book. My stories aren't yours to dig up the histories that this seal tried to erase. But look at me now and how bad you want to taste. They're dropping drones on ant lines now. Check the speed of my damn mouth. Check the grief that lines my smile when they're taking us out child by child. Cause see, I won't do what you tell me has a very different consequence for me. Sada, each refusing you, reusing me, born one of us, revolutionary. I love you all. Thank you.
This is for Palestine, of course, the capital Jerusalem. Unarmed people marching to the wall and they're shooting them. Suppression is a question, resistance is the answer. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, of course, the capital Jerusalem. Unarmed people marching to the wall and they're shooting them. Suppression is a question, resistance is the answer. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza.
All you see is war every time you turn your head and bloodshed on the floor. Mother cries, who cries for her this time? Truth between these walls.
see the lies between the lines. They hide where the bullets coming from the tyrant dressed in our disguise.
I'ma ride until the end, even if I got a push back for all my friends. Cause you know that I'm a fighter, let me see a lighter. And we not gonna stop the Palestine is free. But still you know that I'ma ride until the end, even if I got a push back for all my friends. Cause you know that I'm a fighter, let me see a lighter. And we not gonna stop the Palestine is free.
Taught to not know, taught to be blind, taught to not care. Tell me what's real, borderlines, military despair. How to exist if there's no rights to be human in fear. And if you take away your home, where's the house supposed to live? Taught to not know, taught to be blind, taught to not care. Tell me what's real, borderlines, military despair. How to exist if there's no rights to be human in fear. And if you take away your home, where's the house supposed to live?